took us 3 days. And when we finally got there, we went around the far side of the moon. And to see those ancient craters slip on by, seeing something that people had only dreamed about, it was just amazing.
NASA is 60 years old, and that says as much about our understanding of outer space as it does about our own planet. Hear from Rory Kennedy about her new documentary, Above and Beyond, NASA's Journey to Tomorrow. But first, the New York Times put out a giant investigation into the Trump family's finances. The authors write that, quote, Trump and his siblings set up a sham corporation to disguise millions of dollars in gifts from their parents. And Trump helped his father take improper tax deductions worth millions more. David K. Johnson won a Pulitzer Prize when he was a tax reporter at the New York Times. He's the author of The Making of Donald Trump. And he says the Trumps have always focused on evading inheritance taxes and that many wealthy families are doing the same. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for having me on, Duarte.
So Donald Trump's dad reportedly handed down hundreds of millions of dollars in assets to his kids. How did the president and his family get around paying taxes on all of that?
Well, they did this through calculated, deliberate actions over decades. And the key technique is that they undervalued properties. In one case, more than 1,000 apartments were turned over to the four surviving Trump children, and the value put on them was 6% of what they were really worth. Now, when you're transferring property like real estate, there's a range of values. You know, is your house worth $500,000 or $450,000 or $550,000? But if you put down that your house is worth $30,000, you're committing a crime.
It's extraordinary that no one was able to catch that, if it is in fact true, because there is some doubt. Now, the White House says the IRS signed off on all those maneuvers. Is that true?
Well, we don't know because we don't have Donald Trump's tax returns, but I would not be surprised. But you need to understand the context of that. There are about 160 million taxpayers in this country, including people who don't have to file. They're called tax units. 160 million. We prosecute about 1,600, and most of those are drug dealers or politicians who took bribes. There is no serious effort, and there has not been for decades, to pursue tax cheating at the top. The IRS, in court papers filed in Sacramento about a decade ago, said that in land transfers, the cheating rate, that is the undervaluing of the property given from one generation to the next, ranged from a low of 85% in one state to a high of 100% in most states.
Wait a minute. Let me put this into perspective. You're saying that in 85% of the cases to 100% of the cases in some states, when land is transferred from one generation to the next, there is some form of tax fraud taking place. Do I understand that correctly?
That's exactly right. And I wrote about that in the New York Times even before that document came out. Now, in Trump's case, here's another thing that's significant. If you have so much real estate that you show a negative position on your income tax return and you're an auditor, why would you go and argue with somebody about a value? Because if the tax law, which is filled with benefits for real estate owners, shows that you have a negative income, as Donald Trump did as a man in his 20s, of $4 million, even if you show it really was only $1 million, government doesn't collect a penny. And auditors, there aren't enough of them. These are very complicated issues. And so this kind of cheating not only goes on all the time, but, you know, during the George W. Bush administration, Congress actually made this kind of tax cheating easier. And on top of that, remember that the Trumps used all sorts of schemes. The New York Times, and this is the most technically accurate piece of investigative reporting I've seen in my 50-plus years at this, the New York Times showed that they're set up by Fred Trump. There were 295 streams of income that they used to avoid paying taxes while transferring wealth from the parents to the children. Now, you know, you do something once, twice, so what? 295 different ways that they were cheating the government. And some of those ways, by the way, involved overbilling for things like new refrigerators and stoves in Trump apartments, which allowed them then to argue that people in those apartments who were rent subsidized had to pay even more rent. So as a taxpayer, they ripped you off both directions. And if you're a poor person paying part of that, they ripped you off. This is a family that steals from the poor and thinks nothing of it.
So how have the rules changed since the time the Trump family was moving all the wealth to the next generation? If, in fact, there were loopholes allowing the president's family to do this, have they been closed?
Well, these weren't loopholes. Let me be clear. If the statute of limitations hadn't run out, these are prosecutable crimes, or as the New York Times said, outright fraud. They can be pursued civilly for civil fraud because there's no statute of limitations on that. And Donald Trump was tried twice for civil tax fraud in over his 1984 tax return, and he lost. He lost those trials. Now, the way Congress made it easier to cheat, if you now file a tax return for a gift to your children and you misstate the value, but the auditors don't catch it within 3 years, that's the end of it. You got away with it. It used to be when you died, the IRS could go back through old gift tax returns to see if you'd cheated.
I hear what you're saying, that after 3 years, you're essentially in the clear. And then I also remember you saying that essentially 1,600 cases are prosecuted out of the 160 million taxpayers that are here in the USA.
Right. I mean, there's no serious effort to enforce the tax law. So what we've really created in America is a system where if you are a wage earner or a pensioner, your taxes are withheld before you get your money and you are fully taxed. And there are very few ways you can cheat. But if you own real estate, if you are a business owner, the doors are wide open. And if you're doing it on an international scale, which Donald Trump does now, enormous opportunities to cheat left and right, and no serious enforcement. And one of the things Donald Trump has been doing is pressing Congress to have fewer auditors, and the level of audits has fallen under his administration and will fall a lot more if Congress goes along with his plans to continue cutting the IRS audit staff. Those are the tax police. And what Donald Trump is really doing is attacking, as a Republican, law and order, tax division.
To be clear, are you suggesting that the way he's changing the U.S. tax system is, in effect, a method for him to allow his children to receive a larger share of his fortune?
Well, if he has a fortune. Let me be clear about one other thing. There is not now, and there never has been, Duarte, any verifiable evidence that Donald Trump has ever had $1 billion. I revealed in 1990 that he had a negative net worth. He went around for 4 months calling me a liar until he had to put his own statement into the public record, and it showed he was worth minus $295 million. He ran for president saying he was worth more than $10 billion, but as soon as he became president, he filed a statement saying he was only worth $1.4 billion, and that statement is full of inflated numbers.
Thank you so much for sharing your insight. Pulitzer Prize-winning tax reporter David K. Johnson and author of The Making of Donald Trump. These days, you can read his work at dcreport.org. And I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. You're listening to Press Play. There's a bunch of laws expected to take effect next year here in California. Hear how these new laws could change your life next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. Your governor, Jerry Brown, had a busy few days. He signed more than 1,000 new bills into California law. The bulk of them take effect at the beginning of next year. The new laws range from the nation's toughest net neutrality law and stricter gun control measures to a few inspired by the Me Too movement. John Myers is Sacramento bureau chief at the LA Times. He has details about the big bills that got Governor Brown's signature and the few that didn't. Hey, John.
Hi.
So this net neutrality law could affect all of our lives. The Department of Justice already filed suit to stop it. What does the actual law do?
Well, simply put, I think it's based on what the Obama administration was looking at and had in place with the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, prior to Donald Trump taking over as president. This is a return to that idea that telecommunications providers, internet providers specifically, can't throttle back access. They can't limit particular websites or make you pay more for getting a speed of data one way or slowing it down at different times. It's difficult, I think, for any state to get involved in this, but it's going to put California in the front of a national discussion if, in fact, it ever actually takes effect. The Trump administration immediately filed a suit in federal court saying that this is completely the jurisdiction of the federal government and not a state. And I think we're going to have an interesting discussion in court, and I think in the court of public opinion, about what Californians want when it comes to making sure that everyone's internet access is treated the same without these changes in speed and access.
So that's why the DOJ is against it, because they believe that the federal government should be the ones to decide this and not the state governments.
Yeah, very similar, in fact, to the argument that the Trump administration made about California's sanctuary law, the law that limits the cooperation with local law enforcement with federal immigration agents. We should point out that a federal judge said the law did not go too far, and now the Trump administration has been pondering this idea of an appeal. But it's a similar kind of premise here about where is a state's power end and where does the federal government begin, and I think we're going to see it over net neutrality.
Now, there's another new law that could end an illegal challenge. This one makes California the first state to require publicly traded companies headquartered here to have at least one woman on their board of directors. Explain a little bit more about this law.
Well, I think this is a response to the fact that there were a number of women, and especially women in the California legislature here in Sacramento, who looked at the makeup of these boards of directors of publicly traded corporations and said, where are the women? Where's the gender parity in terms of women getting a fair voice in how these corporations work? And so this was an effort opposed by big businesses in California to change that dynamic, to say at least one woman had to be on these corporate boards, depending on the size of the corporate board, I should point out. The larger boards would have to have more women. It would be a proportional rule. The reaction of the governor to this was, I think it's about time. It's the right cause. I don't know if this will pass legal muster, but I'm going to sign it anyway. And the most interesting part of this one is that he sent a copy of his signing message to the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington, D.C., which, of course, was discussing the Kavanaugh nomination and the accusations of Christine Blasey Ford about sexual assault. We don't know if this is going to take effect. I think the question is whether someone does challenge it before, whether it's successfully challenged. And I think that depends on the business community and these large corporations. Think of the large corporations that are headquartered in California. Would any one of them want to take this on? And I would argue from a PR perspective, it might be pretty bad. But I think that remains to be seen in 2019.
The Me Too movement inspired a lot of protest. And now we're beginning to see that trickle into the laws. Which other Me Too inspired laws did the governor approve? And did he actually veto any?
A little bit of both. So laws that were signed and will take effect next year was a banning of these secret settlements of harassment allegations, saying that no longer you could keep these secret when you settled a harassment claim in the workplace. Also, a law that would place these new limits on these things that are called NDAs, non-disparagement agreements. Basically, you have to sign this. You can never basically talk about what happened, also putting new limits on those when it comes to sexual harassment. On the other side, the governor vetoed one that was closely watched that was an attempt to limit forced arbitration when a harassment claim came forward, essentially saying that a person's condition of employment was that if they had a harassment claim they ever filed, they would have to go into arbitration rather than seek relief in the courts through a lawsuit or something. The governor's veto message said, I don't think this one will pass muster in the courts. He said the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled on something similar to this. And I think you can see the pattern I'm about to point out here, right?
Mm-hmm.
The governor is willing to challenge some legal doctrines, but he's not willing to challenge other ones. And so these ideas of arbitration in sexual harassment will continue. The state will not get involved in that right now.
But in terms of, you know, this whole Black Lives movement, it seems like the state is getting involved. Brown also signed a couple of bills aimed at increasing police transparency. One would actually increase access to body camera footage. Another will open up records about police shootings and officer misconduct investigations. But how are the police departments responding to these new laws?
The law enforcement groups have had tremendous power here in Sacramento over these kinds of things in years past. And let's point out really quickly that they did win a very key debate in Sacramento this year. They successfully killed a bill that would have changed the standard for an officer-involved shooting in terms of when an officer could be charged with it, making it a more strict standard. And it was a bill inspired by the shooting of Stephon Clark, the young man in Sacramento, earlier this year. But the two bills that did become law, that law enforcement was not successful in killing, are these two transparency bills. And honestly, if you look at the one about police records and police personnel files, this is a sweeping change for California. California has some of the most opaque laws about the public's right to see these kinds of misconduct files. This is going to be a big change. I think you're going to see a lot of people demand records that already exist about police officers, law enforcement personnel, and what they have done on the job and allegations of misconduct. And then the body camera footage, of course, that's going to be big too. We know a lot of law enforcement officers wear those devices now. Getting more public access to that video, I think, also is a big victory for those who are saying transparency is really important in policing.
Now, on that gun front, there's a new law that raises the age to buy a rifle or a shotgun to 21. What else got the governor's signature?
This is, you know, gun control has been one of those topics that we talk about every year in the bills that come forward, and we've had sweeping changes on rules on ammunition, for example, in the last couple of years. This one, I think, is probably the biggest one. It was a little bit more of a quiet year, I think, on gun control. We did also see the governor sign into law a lifetime ban on weapons for people who are convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence, and that is a big change.
A lifetime ban on weapons for anyone convicted of a misdemeanor domestic violence charge.
Yes, and so it had been a long ban before, a lifetime ban, obviously much longer. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And the new restrictions on gun ownership for those who have been treated for mental health issues. And I think those two things are inspired by national headlines. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what a new governor, whether it's Democrat Gavin Newsom or Republican John Cox, how a new governor reacts to the topic of gun control when lawmakers come back to Sacramento in January.
Wow. Thank you so much for explaining the details about all these new laws.
You're welcome.
John Myers is Sacramento Bureau Chief at the LA Times. Federal inspectors paid a surprise visit to the Adelanto Detention Facility in San Bernardino. Thousands of migrants have been held up at the facility since 2011. The conditions there shocked the feds. They found nooses made of bed sheets in 15 to 20 cells. A dentist suggested detainees floss their teeth with string from their socks. When you're in pain and when your teeth hurt, you see a doctor immediately, right? That didn't happen for these people. They didn't have that option. It took months to get an appointment, and sometimes those appointments were suddenly canceled. The Inspector General's office at the Department of Homeland Security issued a scathing report. Michael Kaufman is an attorney with the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, good to be with you.
So this is not the first time the Adelanto facility has been in the news. The ACLU publicly called the place out in the past, and in 2015, it submitted a formal complaint to ICE. Last year, three detainees died there within 3 months. The LA Times also reported at least five attempted suicides in less than a year. So this report isn't really surprising. How does it in any way move forward the case for change at this facility?
Yeah, unfortunately, a number of the problems that are documented in the OIG's report are nothing new, particularly concerns about detainees being denied or receiving delayed necessary medical care. But we've been monitoring the facility since it first opened in 2011, and I must admit, I even had my breath taken away by some of the things that are documented in the OIG's report.
How do you take this and energize your efforts to change things?
Well, I mean, I think the OIG's report has really laid bare that the facility is not set up right now to provide the type of conditions that are appropriate for immigration detainees. And I think there's a larger question here. Why are we even locking up many of the people that are held at Adelanto? ICE has available to it extraordinarily effective alternatives to detention, like releasing people on supervision or on ankle bracelets, that have proven effective at ensuring people show up at court hearings. And so why are we keeping people locked up at facilities like these that have such awful medical care that are putting detainees' lives and well-being at risk?
Who's actually locked up at this facility? How would you describe this particular population at Adelanto?
Well, this is actually the largest adult immigration detention center in the country. You have about 2,000 people that are being incarcerated there on any given day. And it's a mix of people. You have people seeking asylum in the United States who are being held while a determination is going to be made as to whether they have the right to remain here and seek protection under asylum laws. You also have longtime residents in the United States who are fighting the government's efforts to deport them. And all the people that are there have the right to be here in the United States while they seek remedies that are made available under the United States immigration laws.
So they have the right to be here, and yet they're living under these conditions. I just want to point out a couple from this report. Guards discipline detainees by segregating them, even if those detainees didn't violate rules. A disabled person was apparently wrongly detained. He needed help getting out of his wheelchair, even just to get into a bed, but he got no help. Detainees had teeth falling out because they waited so long for care. Now, the company that runs this is a private prison company called GEO Group. It's in charge of Adelanto. What do we know about this company?
This is a facility operated by a private prison company. And that means every dollar that they save on medical care or on staffing is a dollar that they're going to make in profit. So it's perhaps unsurprisingly that we've seen time and again that detainees are denied medical and dental care that they need, and that there isn't enough staff on hand at the facility to ensure the detainee's safety.
So you're saying that it boils down to the bottom line when you weigh the life of these people versus the profit that can be made, that they're veering towards the profit, not necessarily the quality of life.
Absolutely. And look, the OIG ultimately recommended that GEO conduct a further investigation to get at the to uncover further what's going on at the facility. But we don't need to do any more investigation to know that there's something seriously wrong there. This is a question of will and of resources. And for GEO, it's a question of their bottom line. Are they willing to put the money that it will take to provide the medical care and other conditions that people need?
ICE spokeswoman Lori Haley said that they take these findings very seriously and that they've hired an inspection firm to look into this matter. Can we rely on this firm to be truly independent and provide some investigation that will lead to change?
ICE has been on notice for years that it has not been providing adequate medical care for detainees held at the facility, often with tragic consequences. The OIG report notes that there's been at least three cases there of detainees who died in part due to medical care that they either were denied or not provided the correct care that they needed. So again, the question is not really about whether we need to do further investigations. It's a question of whether ICE is willing to do what the law and the Constitution require, which is provide for the care and well-being of people in its custody.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Kaufman, he's an attorney with the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. Coming up, NASA started 60 years ago, and 4 years after that, we made it to the moon.
Suddenly, everybody could see the Earth as it truly is, a grand oasis in the vastness of space.
Hear documentary filmmaker Rory Kennedy explain why space exploration has revealed a lot about Earth next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all this week.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
That's President John F. Kennedy at Rice University in 1962. At that moment, JFK inspired us to dream about outer space. But what he was really trying to do is get Americans to support NASA's moon mission. You gotta understand, at the time, NASA was a really young agency, just 4 years old. It started in 1958. Well, 7 years after JFK's speech, we made it to the moon. What's often overlooked about this historic achievement, though, is that from the moon, we started looking back at our own planet, studying it in a way that we had never been able to before. Now, JFK's niece is sharing what NASA's learned about Earth in her new film. Rory Kennedy is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. Her latest film, Above and Beyond, NASA's Journey to Tomorrow, celebrates NASA's 60th anniversary. Rory Kennedy is here in the studio. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've made quite a few documentaries, but this one seems like a departure.
Well, it is. It is in some level. I've never made a science film, and I've never made a film about space. But the Discovery Channel approached me to make this documentary about NASA, and I jumped at the chance. And in part, that was because of the connection with my uncle John F. Kennedy and his involvement with getting us to the moon. But part of it was also a little bit about what you were just saying, this sense of excitement that we had in during the Apollo era that I think so many of the generation now hasn't had access to.
Took us 3 days, and when we finally got there, we went around the far side of the moon. And to see those ancient craters slip on by, seeing something that people had only dreamed about, it was just amazing.
The thrill of sending somebody up into outer space and going to the moon for the first time, and what an extraordinary achievement that was. And I think it really inspired a generation. And I hope that by maybe looking back at NASA and looking at the course of its history over the last 60 years, that hopefully I could help generate that level of excitement with this next generation and help them understand all of the thrilling endeavors that NASA has continued on over the last six decades.
Rory, you mentioned a lot of the highlights for NASA and the different planets that we are now studying, the ones we've discovered. One of the moments that struck me in your film was when you talk about the worlds that we have visited. We often think about a man walking on the moon, but with our machines, with our instruments, we've visited quite a few places.
Yeah. You know, NASA had a mission pretty early on to visit all of the planets in our solar system, and remarkably, it did.
We actually went to Pluto, too. The culmination, I think, of this is the universe is far more wonderful and strange than we ever thought. It's sort of the miracle of exploration.
You know, we send up orbiters, we send up landers, we send up different, and then of course we have telescopes. And so all of these instruments give us a pretty astounding picture of what is surrounding us. I think it's interesting to look back at where we were 60 years ago. And at that point in time, really everything we knew about outer space, we knew from the back end of a telescope here on Earth, right? And now we've sent telescopes up into outer space. The Hubble telescope is an extraordinary thing. And with Hubble, we've seen, you know, we've seen stars being created like our star, the Sun, was. We can see that for the first time in our history.
But we also see them dying, though.
And we see them dying in these supernovas. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling what we've learned over these last 60 years, but it's awesome.
It's so easy to get caught up in the enormity of space. But if we focus on our neighbors right now, when you look at Mars and Venus, very, very similar to us. And yet, as far as we know it, life can't exist. Was there ever a point when there could have been life on Venus?
Well, what's curious is that we know that there was water on Mars, and that Mars was much like the Earth 3.5 billion years ago when the Earth started having life. And there is a feeling that there was maybe life on Mars at that time.
But what happened?
And so that is a big question. And, you know, similarly with Venus, Venus could have been a planet that supported life. It's now, because of it, it's has a runaway greenhouse effect. It's 900 degrees on Venus.
900 degrees on Venus because of a runaway greenhouse effect.
Yes, so, you know, that is concerning. And I think what one of the lessons that NASA has learned from studying these other planets and studying the planets in our solar system is the understanding that planets change, and planets change over time. And there's an awareness that our planet is changing at a very alarming rate right now. And that is due to human released carbon emissions that we are doing to this planet. And the planet is actually changing as a result of that.
And NASA research substantiates that.
100%.
As scientists, we're just taking the most precise data that we can. It's open data. It's factual. For instance, the enormous droughts and fires that we have around the world are directly related to a warmer planet.
I mean, I talk to dozens of scientists and astronauts and, you know, some of the smartest people and who have kind of led these efforts over the last 40, 50 years. I don't know if they're Democrats or Republicans. I still don't know. But I do know that what they're telling me and what the science proves and shows is that the Earth is warming due to the release of carbon in the environment, and we're doing that.
It's a little depressing when you think about that.
Yeah.
But our space program is exploring a lot of different planets, a lot of different areas. There was one planet in your documentary that, if I understood it correctly, is it covered in ice? It doesn't have an ozone, but it's ice?
Yes. Yeah. It's under the surface of the planet. And they think that there's a good chance. I mean, most of the scientists I spoke to felt that in our lifetime, we will find life not only in our galaxy, but in our solar system. And that is one of the locations where they think they'll find life. Another place is Mars. I mean, it's dumb life, I think. I mean,
dumb life, right? Not as sophisticated as us, that we're going to be burning up our planet, but you.
We have plenty of dumb life on this planet, I know. But
so the water is in the planet?
Yeah, it's underneath the surface.
Fascinating. So yeah. There could be life forms that are just not being exposed to sun like us. They don't need as much sun.
Yes.
At its core, your film is not necessarily about the science, but about the people and humanity. Was there one person in particular, one interview that moved you?
Well, I was, really humbled by this process. And I loved meeting so many of the people who are leading the efforts at NASA, and also the people who are just working day in and day out on these extraordinary projects, which really help enlighten all of us. I think the person that stuck with me probably the most is Pierce Sellers.
Why?
Pierce is an amazing person who's an astronaut. He's done many spacewalks. He's gone up to the International Space Station and off of the shuttle. And he's an extraordinarily accomplished person. About 2 or 3 years ago, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
Oh, no.
And so he was given a short period of time to live, under a year. And so he wrote this really amazing op-ed piece for the New York Times, where he talked about how he came home from having been diagnosed, got his papers in order, and then was faced with the decision of, how am I going to spend this last year of my life? And he decided, after reflecting on it, that he was going to go back to work the next day at NASA. And he decided that because he felt that there was such an urgency of the work that he was doing around Earth science.
I was an Earth system guy, so I thought I understood what I would see when I went into space. And I was surprised to see how thin the atmosphere was, how really thin it is around the world, and obviously how easily influenced it is by what we do. NASA has an immense capability to really study these changes. how much fossil fuel we burn, how much carbon dioxide we release into the atmosphere. The kind of climate we're going to get depends entirely on us humans and what we decide to do.
And what he said to me is, we are on a train wreck, and it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And the science is definitive, and people on this planet are not understanding the urgency of this matter. And I am going to spend every moment of every waking day for the remainder of my life committed to helping people understand the urgency of this.
And when did he pass away?
He passed away about a year ago. And I dedicated the film to Pierce. And I think, you know, that interview in part also impacted me so much that I framed the film a bit based on his experience and his expertise, and trying to help, I hope, spread the word that these scientists and their findings. You know, NASA is interesting because it's a civilian agency, and its mission is to gather information and share it with people all over the world. So there's no part of the information really that it keeps to itself. But they're not in a position to be advocates. You know, they're not a lobbying organization. They're not an advocacy organization. And so they provide the facts and the science, and much of what we know about climate change is because of NASA. You know, they're not on the front lines, so they might not be the people who we get the information from. And so I think a lot of people aren't even aware that NASA is doing this work.
And yet they are.
And so they are the source, but they're not really in a position to advocate. And of course, I'm a filmmaker, and I'm able to kind of take their information and try to share it in a way that I think is in the spirit of the organization and reflects the science and the facts. And so, you know, I take that responsibility very seriously.
Thank you so much for joining us and chatting about your new documentary.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Rory Kennedy, documentary filmmaker. Her film, Above and Beyond, NASA's Journey to Tomorrow, will be in LA theaters starting on October 5th, and it airs on the Discovery Channel on October 13th. There are sounds that some people say induce physical reactions. Up next, take a trip with me into the world of ASMR. Next. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand all week. You ever heard a sound that makes your body feel a certain kind of way? We're talking about those sounds today and the way they affect your body. Take this one, for example.
Good evening. Hello, how are you? I'm going to reply to 25 questions in a whisper like this.
You feel any tingling? A sensation, perhaps, that starts in your head and spreads through your body? Did you like it? Apparently, a lot of people do. And that's why this YouTube video from 2 days ago already has almost 300,000 views. And it's not just the whispering. You bring these videos up not for what you see, but rather what you hear. All sorts of videos. People brushing their hair, tapping on furniture, gently chewing things. These sounds are part of what's called ASMR. It stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. But if you ask people who are part of a growing internet subculture about them, they'll say it's a braingasm. Now, the internet subculture is getting more and more mainstream. Rosie Spinks is a reporter for Quartzy. It's the lifestyle edition of Quartz. She's based in London and recently wrote about how BBC Radio is now trying to make you tingle. Hey, Rosie.
Hey there.
So, can you describe ASMR? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk on the internet and it's sort of difficult to understand.
Sure. So most simply, you explained it quite well. It's this tingling feeling in the scalp and a sense of relaxation that some people feel in response to certain stimuli. So those stimuli tend to be things that are quite repetitive and non-threatening and also very mundane. So as you said, watching someone brush their hair or chew something very lightly or a soft whispering voice tell you a bunch of nonsense or listening to someone rake a mini Zen garden, these are all things that can provoke an ASMR response in some people.
Has it been scientifically proven to actually do something, or is this just sort of hearsay? Or
there certainly are people who are looking into the research of it. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. It was more or less born of the internet. It was coined by a web designer in 2010. So not quite enough time really has elapsed for it to be sort of, you know, a bona fide scientific concept, if you will. But I certainly think online there's enough people who sort of share this sensation and very much feel that it's real and can help even with things like depression and anxiety.
The BBC is now getting into this, you write. BBC Radio 3 didn't call its slow radio program ASMR, but you say that's essentially what it is. Why do you say that?
Yeah, it certainly shares a lot of the same characteristics, you know, listening to a slow walk through the countryside, you know, the crunching leaves underfoot.
Lovely optimistic feeling of the beginning of a walk. It's a perfect place for it. Violets and celandines and hedgerows.
Or listening to an old collection of ticking clocks. These are things that are not particularly exciting, but very pleasurable for some people. And interestingly, Alan Davey, the controller for BBC Radio 3, said they were giving a more permanent spot to this slow radio, which he sort of called meditative and slightly old-fashioned, in part because it has wider appeal for younger people as well. And I think, you know, even broader than ASMR, everyone, myself included, is just exhausted by the pace of modern life and email and Twitter. So whether you feel those tingling sensations or not, you know, listening to a gentle walk through the countryside and all the lovely noises that come around with that on your commute certainly would be more relaxing than listening to the train announcer.
You said that it appeals to younger listeners. Often we think about, you know, BBC Radio in particular as appealing to an older generation and a lot of that opera, some classical music. But these sounds, you're saying younger people, millennials, are actually tuning into that?
Yeah, I mean, even younger, if you want to talk about sort of ASMR channels and ASMR celebrities on YouTube, you know, there are ASMR celebrities who take requests for the type of videos that people want to listen to. And it kind of goes against this idea we have about short internet attention spans. You know, these videos are long, and it reminds me in a way to the sort of counterintuitive appeal of podcasts in a time when attention spans are supposedly, you know, no more than 140 or 280 characters. People are sort of craving that controlled experience, that intimacy, that feeling of calmness. And obviously ASMR is a more extreme version of that because it provokes an almost physical response in some people. But I think, you know, younger people crave that as much as anyone else, especially as they spend so much time on the internet and on these devices.
How long are we talking about? Are we talking about 10, 15 minutes or even longer?
Oh, no. I mean, we can go more than an hour.
More than an hour. Any other examples of ASMR going mainstream?
Yeah. So a colleague of mine at Quartz wrote a piece last summer about IKEA, which made a 25-minute ad spot, which featured a lot of its products in a bedroom. And it was done in an ASMR style. And so they felt that ASMR was a natural fit for marketing their neutral, everyday, you know, your sheets, your pillows, your hangers as they sort of chime together as you take off a blouse.
The cushion inside that is expanding and contracting is called the Fia Drawer. It's just $5.99 for 26 ounces of duck feathers.
They were using it to sell their products, obviously. So they were associating this kind of comfort and calmness that an ASMR experience can give you with the experience of walking into an orderly and neat IKEA bedroom.
Okay, so ASMR.
I'm sold personally.
So do you ever get the tingling? Like, do you feel it when you're listening to these videos or some strange sound or some soothing sound? Do you feel something radiating from your head throughout your body?
I can't say I feel it in the way that many people online sort of say that they feel it. But I there are certainly sounds that I find, you know, incredibly pleasing, even if it's just, you know, a pair of shoes that I walk around in all day that I like the way they hit the ground. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that I am a person with the ASMR experience on a daily basis.
So what about these chewing ice videos?
I discovered this recently when I was writing a history of ice cubes for the Quartz Obsession email, which is a deep dive we do into a random thing from the economy. And ice cubes have a very interesting history. And I found many videos online of people chewing ice cubes. And in fact, people were interested in listening and viewing videos of certain types of ice cubes. There's a cult fandom of Sonic, the fast food chain's ice cubes, which are more like ice chips and sound different when you chew them. And of course, there's ice with more air pockets in it, and that sounds different. So yeah, chewing ice cubes, there's a big market for it online.
So we've spoken about ASMR as something that induces pleasure, but is the reverse true? Can it actually make you uncomfortable? Can it cause any sort of pain?
That's a good question. I suppose if you really, I could imagine some people hate the sound of someone chewing ice cubes or chewing on, you know, a crunchy vegetable or the like. I think what sort of is an important point is that anything can be ASMR. It's whatever provokes the response in an individual who experiences the sensation. So you can't really say, you know, this noise or this example is ASMR and this one isn't. It's really a matter of personal response and preference.
One person's tingle is another person's cringe. Rosie Spinks covers lifestyle for Quartzy. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now we see our Stylig hangers as they slide along the bar. They cost just $4.99 for a 5-pack at your local IKEA. And listen to that slide.
Those sounds are doing something to me. We have Christian Bordell here with some feedback. Christian, did you tingle too?
Hi there, Duarte.
You know, Halloween is close. That sounds creepy.
Are you feeling me, Duarte? Is this doing anything for you? What do you think?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, some people really spark to this stuff, but not everyone does. Some people just get a little bit creeped out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Here, let's try something. I want to try create a little bit of our own ASMR. Here we go. This is a piece of tissue paper or kitchen paper.
Oh, my goodness. I think my hair's just stood up just listening to that.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Like, just focusing so intensely on one little tiny sound that is, you know, enhanced that way, and the volume is sort of brought up, so that's all you're really focused on, and it's just the sound itself.
But there must be other sounds that just sort of do it for you in terms of just irritate you. Those are soothing.
Here, try this one. This is a staple machine that I'm opening and closing.
I think that may be the welcome sound to purgatory, but it's a stapler. That you're doing.
One more little sound. Let's try a teacup with my fingernails on it.
I could mess with that.
Uh-huh. All right, there you go. There's our ASMR feedback for today.
Thank you so much. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. I'll be with you all week. Meet me here again tomorrow.